You're listening to the Body Pros coverage of the 49th Annual InterScience Conference on Antimicrobial Agents and Chemotherapy, also known as ICAC 2009. The conference took place in San Francisco, California, from September 12th to September 15th, 2009.
Welcome. This is Bonnie Goldman, Editorial Director of The Body Pro. Right now, I'm in the poster session where researchers are standing in front of their posters. There's nothing like hearing the results of research directly from those who have actually conducted the research. It is these women and men who are transforming HIV treatment and care. In this podcast, the researchers will introduce themselves and then summarize their study. After their summary, I'll ask a few questions.
I'm Kimberly Smith from Rush University Medical Center in Chicago, and I am at this year's ICAC presenting an analysis from the GRACE study. The GRACE study is the gender, race, and clinical experience study, and the data that I'm presenting is outcomes by race at week 48. And just to remind people about a little bit about what GRACE was a multi-centered, open-label, phase 3 study that was done really primarily in the U.S., but also there were a few sites in Canada and Puerto Rico. And it was a study that looked at treatment-experienced patients. But the thing that was unique about this study was that it targeted women and people of color. And so if you look at the demographics of who was enrolled, it was about 70% people of color in this trial. And so what I'm presenting here today is a race analysis. So it was a single-arm study really just looking at some treatment-experienced patients, and investigators chose a regimen that had to include darunavir and then whatever else they thought the patient might need. Some of the patients got atrovirine when it was still experimental at the time. And we are looking to see what the responses were in sort of what have traditionally been described as special populations, so community of color and women. And what we show here in this analysis was that black patients did not respond as well as Caucasian or Hispanic patients. And that was particularly true when you look at black women. So the response rate for black women was about 46%, and the response rates for, you can see down there, the response rates for Caucasian women was more like 60%, and for Caucasian men, again, more like 60%.
Could you define a response?
Viral load undetectable at level of less than 50. Typical response rates.
And how does that compare to how does that compare to other populations?
The thing that's unique about the GRACE study is that we don't really have a good comparator because we don't have, this is really the first treatment experience study to have a large proportion of people of color in it to be able to answer this question. We have lots of naive studies. The HEAT study is the one that I presented at IAS that had a good proportion of people of color, and we showed that that difference existed there. This is the first treatment experience study to actually show that difference because it was the first one to enroll a large number of patients. So so the response rates weren't as good for black patients. And that was true whether you looked at the whole T-Lover analysis or even if you looked at excluding people who discontinued for reasons other than virologic failure. So if you took out people who discontinued and all that, the difference was still present. But there were a couple of things that stood out. As I mentioned already, black women didn't respond as well. People keep asking me sort of why do I think that that is? And I really think that there are a lot of factors that we can't necessarily measure. I think that patients in this population and HIV-infected patients really in the United States that are black are more likely to be poor, are more likely to have other competing challenges, priorities. They may be still challenged by issues of substance use. There's just a long list of things that you can't necessarily get at in a clinical trial. And so what this showed is that even in a situation where folks have access to medical care, and clearly folks have access to drugs because all the drugs were provided in this study, that unless we deal with some of the other challenges that exist for people that make it hard for them to continue in a study, that we can't get their response rates up to what is the case in the general population. So to me, I think the take-home message here is that we need to start to design studies that actually identify individuals that may have challenges and intervene for those individuals before they actually end up with virologic failure so that, you know, we can get all of the populations up to what I think is the standard. The standard for naive trials is to get 80%, 85% of the population undetectable. If we can raise that bar for black patients, then we raise the bar for everybody else. And so I think that that should be our new challenge, is that we try to get everybody up to a standard as opposed to drug A versus drug B. It should be about getting everybody up to, I think, what now is the standard of care.
Do you think that other studies have missed this population because they never enrolled them in the studies? And this was true all along?
In treatment experience studies, you rarely see a proportion of African-American patients is more than 10%, 10 or 12%. Some of it is that the African-American populations are later in the treatment. You have fewer people that have multi-drug resistance to get into some of the treatment experience trials. So that may have been some of the driving force for that. For the naive trials, I do think that now the drug companies are being challenged to enroll a more diverse population, and when they're doing that, then we're able to have enough patients in the study to be able to see those differences. But this is not a new finding. I mean, the reality is that we've had at least three studies in the ACTG that have shown that blacks didn't respond as well as whites, and these were all naive studies. The HEAT study I just presented, again, showed the same thing. And what's unique about those studies is they did have 30 or 35%, 40% people of color, so you had enough people to be able to do the comparison. And when you do that, then you're able to see that what differences exist. I think now we don't need more studies that show that the differences exist. We need studies that actually seek to get rid of the difference. How do we get rid of the difference? We know that it's there. How do we intervene? And
no genetic issue that's here. It's all life issues.
In this particular study, there's nothing that suggests that it's a drug-driven issue. And the same thing was true in the HEAT study. So, you know, the HEAT study looked at two different regimens. The response rate was lower for blacks in both of those regimens. In this study, the only drug that they got that was across the board in all the patients was darunavir. And the other studies of darunavir haven't shown a racial difference in response rate. So I don't think that it's necessarily a drug-driven thing or a toxicity-driven thing. When we look at the toxicities by race, we don't see any differences. I think that this is primarily due to dropout, which clearly was shown to be higher for black patients, lower adherence, which we did show that there was about a 10% difference in the proportion of individuals who had greater than 95% adherence when you compared blacks to Caucasians. I think if you take all those things together, those two things, adherence and dropout, those are primarily the things that I think are leading to the difference. We have to address why do people drop out, and then why is there lower adherence, and have strategies to try to fix those things.
Wasn't this trial unique in that there was greater support for adherence and
Absolutely.
Greater support?
It was unique in the sense that it really went out of its way to try to attract women and had supports in place for women. And so, you know, there was a lot of advertisement, a lot of support. People literally got birthday cards sent to them on their birthday. We made a point of having really women-centered advertising. Everybody focused on trying to make sure that their needs were met. I think some sites were more successful at doing that than other sites. And so that's how we did a good job of enrolling this study. There's no question it enrolled very rapidly. And industry has, in general, been nervous about enrolling studies with a large proportion of people of color, a large proportion of women, because they thought they would never fill them. It takes too long. This study enrolled very rapidly. And the reason is that they made those extra efforts to try to attract women and make them feel like this was a study designed for them.
But isn't one of the dangers of that there's some sort of bias in the study, so that the researchers who were trying to enroll people who wouldn't normally be good candidates for a trial because they might not be adherent, because they might have other competing issues? Could there be a bias in the results?
I think, sure, you could argue that some institutions, folks assume that someone's not going to be good for a study on the basis of them being a woman that's a single mother with kids, or being an African-American patient with a history of drug use. I mean, people make assumptions. But when you look at the studies that have looked at whether or not those are predictors of adherence, they're not. We don't do a good job of predicting ahead of time who's going to adhere. So I do think that, you know, studies that try to enroll a diverse population that represents what our clinics look like really are going to be more accurate at telling us what our challenges are in getting people to undetectable. If we only enroll what we believe to be the ideal candidates for clinical trials, then sure, we'll know what the response rates are in those folks, but they won't at all be reflective of what's going on in real life.
Uh-huh. And isn't that true? That's what's been going on, the sort of recruitment of ideal candidates.
I think that has happened in some settings. I mean, you know, you want, if you enroll somebody in a study, you want them to stay. And so if you're worried that maybe this study will have a negative effect, and that because we showed that African Americans were more likely to discontinue, folks won't want to enroll African Americans in their study. I hope that that's not the case. I hope that what happens is that we recognize that we need to put some supports in the place to try to make sure that patients don't discontinue. Maybe if they can't make their visit, we find a way to go get them and bring them for their visit. So I hope that what we'll learn from this is not that we don't want to enroll people of color into these trials because they bring down our response rates. I hope what we'll learn is that we need to do some of the extra things in order to try to bring the response rates of everybody up. And then ultimately, I keep saying to folks, if we bring up the response rates for the toughest to treat folks, then that brings up the response rates for everybody.
Uh-huh. And are people convinced?
Some are.
Is this a real uphill battle then?
It is. I mean, it's a challenge for myself and other colleagues have for a long time been pushing to get more studies like this done. Now, I think the next push is that we design studies that intervene for folks who don't do as well. But if I see that someone doesn't reach a certain threshold early on, like at week 2 or week 4, they haven't got a viral load response is what I expect for that by that time, then I should do something. I can call them up or have a nurse or a peer or someone call them up and say, I don't think you're taking all your medicines. Tell me why. Is it that you're having a side effect? Is it that you got a copay and you couldn't get your medicines till a week late? You know, what is it? Find out what it is and then try to fix the problem rather than the way we traditionally do studies that we enroll somebody and then we look at them at week 16 to see if they've responded like we want. And if they haven't, they're a failure. And if they have, then they're a success. And that's not good enough anymore.
So do you think there's money for this kind of support?
We're pushing. Uh-huh. You know, I was talking to Jules Levin, and I've talked to folks from the NIH, and I've talked to all of the people at all the industries and say we have to invest in successful responses. And it's not just about drug A versus drug B. It's about everybody responding in a similar way. How do we get the folks with the most challenges up to the standard? And if we can do that, again, that raises the bar for everybody.
Right. And this is really providing a window into the lives of African-American women who are not in this study, who are not doing well, who are dying in the South, for instance, and we're not really reporting on that.
If you look at any of the data on who's dying from HIV nowadays, there's no question that blacks are more likely to die, black women in particular. And they're more likely to be diagnosed late. That's shown in this study as well. I mean, the individuals in this study were more like black folks were more likely to have more advanced disease than the other individuals in the study. And so, yeah, I think this is kind of a microcosm of what's going on in the larger society. And what we know is that if you have virologic failure, you're more likely to go on to have a higher rate of mortality. If we can't get people suppressed, we can't keep them in studies. And in many cases, what that means is we can't keep them in care. If we can't keep them in care, they're not going to do well. Talk to any provider and they will tell you that nowadays we don't see that many deaths, but the deaths that we see are people that we have a hard time keeping in care. We have a hard time keeping them on their medicines. It's very unusual to see people die with an undetectable viral load these days. It happens, but it's rare. More often than not, it's people who can't stay on a study or can't stay in the clinic. They can't take their medicines consistently either. They're pulled away by, you know, issues of substances or other challenges that exist in their lives. But those are the folks that are dying.
So don't we need another study to see what are the issues that these women are struggling with?
I don't think we need another. We got studies. So, you know, if you look, I think what you can learn from the cohort studies, like the WISE analyses, you can see the challenges that exist in these people's lives. I mean, one of the WISE studies show that the average income for the women in that cohort was $4,500 a year. $4,500 a year, that by itself is a huge challenge. That means that your priority, you know, the priorities in your life are not just about getting your pills swallowed. It's about making sure you got food on the table, making sure you got a place to live, taking care of your kids. I mean, there's so many other things. Much more depression seen in HIV-infected women compared to not. I mean, all of those issues, I think, are ones that we've documented in a number of trials. Now it's about how do we intervene to try to get past them.
The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebodypro.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us.
Thanks for listening to The Body Pro's coverage of ICAC 2009. For more podcasts from this conference, as well as additional articles, interviews, and highlights, visit us online at thebodypro.com/ICAAC2009.